This is The Producers, a podcast. The biggest names in audio production, station sound, radio imaging, branding, and voiceover. Interviews, tips, tricks, advice. To be a part of the show, visit RyanOnTheRadio.com. Now, The Producers with Ryan Dreen.
Another edition of The Producers Podcast. Hello, hello. Thank you so much for checking it out. I will spend, as per usual, very little time on the intros, outros, etc. Mitch Todd is the guest. We spent almost an hour chatting. I learned lots. He told fun stories. And I think for me, I wanted more of an insight into the workings of the big satellite world to see kind of how the production was set up, how the team was set up, their duties, the tools they have. And I think Mitch was wide open with all of that information. So anyway, it'll be a great interview. I do want to point out that I have spent a little more time, as I mentioned in previous episodes, working on the blog, content for the blog, text-based interviews there. I even did my first video interview. And then just trying to write up, you know, a post that I think will be useful to voiceover talent and production talent throughout America and the world. So yeah, I mean, check out the blog if you get a chance. It definitely gets updated more often with what I think is better content. And because these podcasts do take me quite a bit of time, and like I've mentioned, also I have a lot more work these days. It just takes me longer to get them out there. I apologize that they do take me longer to get out there. Standalone, I think they're still really good, so people will hopefully continue to listen to them. But it's taken me, I mean, essentially I'm putting them out about once a month, where my original goal was, let's say, every 3 weeks. So, you know, I apologize for the delay in these, but I make up for it with more content that's a little quicker to consume on the main website, RyanOnTheRadio.com, and on the kind of the main left side is all the different blog posts. And then up top, you'll see the blog menu, which has all the categories within that. I do want to point out, in fact, I'm going to my website now just to make sure I say it correctly. There is a post that I did with Robin Marshall, who is the new, she's heading up Cumulus Sound Solutions. I believe that's the name of their department. Anyway, she moved to Dallas. She's been a pretty big mover and shaker in the world of radio in general. Jock in New York City, voice talent all over the nation, and in fact, I'm sure internationally. But a heck of a writer. She's got a great book, and I believe another one on the way, and a super producer. Just a creative talent. So I wouldn't mind you checking out that 9.5 questions that I did with her online. But if you're interested in a copy of her book, from this point, it is Tuesday. You have 3 days to share the Facebook post on the Producers Podcast Facebook page. There is a post. Just simply share it and you'll be in the running for that book if you would like the book. If you don't want the book, well, then read the interview anyway and check out the podcast Facebook page, but you don't have to share crap. I don't, you know, whatever. Also, I will make mention that I did a video interview with Lori Lewis, a social media strategist working, working with Jacobs Media. I had a lot of fun doing this. It was my first video interview. We used the Google Hangout to do that, and she had a ton of great information. I tried to gear that interview towards sort of the individual media professional and what you can do on social media to brand yourself. But if you work for a company, I think there's a lot of great information in there as well to, get your message out there, to get your brand out there and to increase your business. So do check that out as well on the blog, on the website, RyanOnTheRadio.com. Thanks again to Lori Lewis for that. Kick it off here. Mitch Todd sent me a very cool piece of audio, the Paul McCartney trailer that he voiced, there's another voice or two in there, but he's the main voice of this trailer. We'll kick it off with that, and just something really cool to show you what happens over there at Sirius XM. And then I'll round out the podcast at the end of part two. Yes, this is a part two-parter, and tell you what's coming up. Okay, here we go. Mitch Todd.
Coming soon. Only on Sirius XM.
This feels exciting.
December of 2010.
The time's right.
Oh my God!
Ladies and gentlemen,
thank you very much, everybody.
Live in New York City.
Yesterday.
why I got satellite radio.
In some mysterious way, it summed up what we were doing. Let's go in. It's time to have fun.
Hello, hello. This is Paul McCartney. Don't worry, it gets louder.
In celebration of 20 million subscribers, SiriusXM presents Paul McCartney. Live at the Apollo Theater in New York City, December 13th.
It's a collection. It's an entity. It's a show.
And it's exclusively for those who can hear my voice. Sirius.com or XMRadio.com for official rules and the chance to win tickets and a trip to New York City for you and three of your friends to experience. Paul McCartney, a thanks a 20 million concert event.
And it's exclusively for you on Sirius XM.
This episode is exciting for me because I have the one and only Mitch Todd, and he's a big wig, one of the biggest of wigs. Mitch, thanks for the time, man. Appreciate it.
A big wig. Somebody once said I look like Ben Franklin, so maybe that's what you're referring to.
Oh, hey,
I used to get the pen Gillette thing for years until I cut my ponytail off recently.
Oh, was that and you had that for a long time, right?
Yeah, about a good 10-year run there on that, and I finally decided to come out of the 70s and move into the 80s with my style.
Or you just decided to finally grow up, maybe?
A little bit.
Typically, we guys in the creative side of things don't like to do that.
No, I still enjoy not growing up and hiding away in my little hole, but unfortunately, running the production department, I can't always do that. I still have to go to a lot more boring meetings now than I ever used to.
Something on my list of questions a little later on. I want to get into that. But first, let's, I'm going to keep this interview a lot more focused on just like today, you know, day-to-day operations at your level. But give people a brief background because you've been around. And do you call yourself a Cleveland guy, or is that just a place you were for a while?
Well, it's both, actually. I was born in Cleveland. My father worked for the railroad, actually, although he was on radio and in community theater for years, too. But I left when I was like 7 years old, so I actually went back twice to work for the same guy, John Gorman, who was the fairly legendary PD at the Buzzard in Cleveland. Mm-hmm. And he also ran, when I first back to Cleveland, it was a WMJI, Magic, the number one station in town with Lanigan and Malone in the morning, and pretty solid number one all the time. And then we later then purchased the Buzzard, and he kind of re-engineered it as the next generation, kind of playing modern rock with, you know, some classic mixed in. And that probably was one of my two most favorite kind of guerrilla warfare radio stations I worked for. I worked there back when the Howard Stern wire cutting incident occurred. One of our engineers cut the wires to our competition's broadcast that when Stern was in town giving a funeral for John Lanigan. But that was pretty fun stuff.
Wow.
But yeah, I started my first radio job was actually in a little town called Bassett, Virginia. My father got transferred down to a town called Roanoke, Virginia. And he did some work with a guy named Adrian Kronauer, who wrote Good Morning Vietnam.
Yeah, yeah.
He's a good friend of the family. He actually used to babysit me, too. But
wow.
And so I got a real early taste. I was one of those, you know, 12 years old, I knew what I was going to do.
Yeah.
I had two Juliet cassette tape decks, an old surplus FM military transmitter, and had my own little pirate radio station by the time I was 14. And was working in radio full-time by the time I was 17, so...
Yeah, you know. I was going to say, I've noticed doing these interviews now for almost 4 years that it's almost literally half and half. People who start in their middle or late teens, or people who go off and do something else for a while and then find radio later. You know, there doesn't seem to be much middle ground.
Well, I got my first gig, and I finished high school during that, and I took about 2.5 months of college, and then I... was offered a better job in Roanoke I'm from the analog age, so we're talking AM, when AM still ruled, and I worked for the country station there in town. We were number one, and I did afternoons, and eventually went to mornings, and Then about 84, got out of being on air. Didn't like it. Moved to Atlanta with my current wife and got a job at Kix 101, Atlanta's country leader, as a 7 to midnight jock. And about 5 months into that, a guy named, I shouldn't name him actually, the production director had kind of a nervous breakdown, and they gave me a shot at doing it. I said, give me 4 weeks. And luckily, I'd had some experience in multi-track studios that I kind of forgot to mention. Back in Virginia, 16-track studio, did a lot of music stuff there. And then I have had the real fortunate experience of working with the folks from Master Sound Studio in Atlanta, which was the first studio in the country, actually, to get an SSL console,
okay,
a Synclavier system, Genelec self-powered monitors that were as big as a refrigerator. So that gave me a real edge early on.
You were
in
right place, right time for that sort of transition.
Yeah, those guys just happened to be the guys that serviced our MCI two tracks, you know, mm-hmm, tape decks. And that's how I got to be friends with the Mastersons who ran it. And that gave me a real edge from the very beginning. It's like almost a full sail recording class kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
It taught me a lot. So that gave me the edge with the technology of the day, of the era.
Mm-hmm.
So then I bounced around the country and did mostly rock, hot AC radio. I didn't really like country. I just kind of started in it. But Adrian was my muse. He worked at a little UHF TV station and ran a big 200,000-watt FM beautiful music station.
Hmm.
I guess my first gig technically was he let me read the weather overnight Sundays and watch the automation machine. So that really was my very first gig, I guess. But
that's great. So obviously you've had a few stops in between, but you've been at Sirius now for since its inception. Is that true?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
I started here. I'm going on my 12th anniversary here in 2000, and I was working in Cleveland actually. My second time working for the Buzzard back in the Clear Channel era of it.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife wanted to finish a master's degree at Columbia University. She was working part-time in New York, and she said, well, I followed you all around the country, and it's time to make a move for me. So I came here, and it seemed at the time XM was going to be the premier satellite company. There were two separate companies,
yeah,
of course, then, and as the FCC mandated.
That's what it seemed like to me, too, also. I'm just going to interject.
Yeah, that's fine. I was talking to Dave Logan. I got in touch with Dave Logan then at the time, and I knew they were going to have some presence here in New York, but they said really they wanted all their creative folks in D.C. at the time.
Mm-hmm.
That later changed, and they ended up hiring Bill Cates, who I actually knew from many years ago when he was up for a job, the first job in Cleveland I took. He was the second runner-up candidate, but I'd met him, and nice guy. But at the time, they were just going to do a DC and just have basically, as Dave Logan put it, a lab coat guy watching the engineer in the front door, making sure the tape decks work.
Yep.
To record all the stars that come through New York. But of course that changed, and so I took the job at Sirius, thinking, okay, I'll do this for a year, see what the hell I want to do, and I'll either do that and become a goat farmer or do something completely different, because at that point the writing was on the wall with radio. It was kind of going downhill in my eyes, and I was already ready to retool for something else.
So you really did, in the area of the year 2000, saw that radio was on its way downhill, and you were looking at that point.
Well, when I took the gig, but the second time at the Buzzard in Cleveland, it was a combined cluster. I can't even remember the call letters now. The rest other two stations, but I'll put it to you this way. When I went into the thing, I designed my dream studio. I got everything I wanted, a brand new Warband Odyssey, the brand new Mackie D8B digital console the week it came out,
mm-hmm,
Neumann U87s, everything I asked for I got. And by the time I left, 4 or 5 years later, three, whatever it was, that's when the Clear Channel started having you do, well, yeah, we want you to do Dayton. We want you to do some stuff with Cincinnati. We want you to do this.
Mm-hmm.
We'll give you $3,000 extra bucks or whatever. And I'm like, and I was also very well paid there. And I kind of saw the writing on the wall. I think that I was going to be probably downsized,
yeah,
financially at least, so.
Yeah, it's not usually the best thing to be the highest paid guy.
Nope. You kind of got a target on your back at that point. But you know, I'm really glad I did it. It's like a whole different career, and I started at the ground up when everybody couldn't even pronounce it. Cyrus, who are you working for? And you know, back then in the early days, it was great because we got to throw anything we wanted against the wall. I mean, I got there before even that we were essentially broadcasting.
Yeah,
and we played around for about a year as we honed the stations and developed them. It was very unique then because what we did initially was we got to do all the imaging. The programmers didn't have anything to do with it. We just said, here's your imaging. This is what you're airing.
Okay.
It was a very, very unique situation. Kind of backwards, really. But
well,
it's great for producers.
Opposite, you know, of the status quo, certainly.
And the beauty is still with our commercial-free business model, on all our music channels, which I'm in charge of the music channels, and then we service the marketing department as well. I've got about maybe 14, 15 producers between D.C. and New York. But it's still, we really don't have to do commercials, except we just actually just did one this week for a terrestrial radio buy, which I think most stations turned us down.
I remember early on. Wait, maybe I'm trying to remember how it went early on. A lot of stations took the Sirius and XM buys because they thought you guys would absolutely be no threat whatsoever.
Oh, yeah. But early on, we did a lot of radio.
Yeah.
Yep. And, you know, we, of course, you know, the rest is history. We're on the brink of bankruptcy. Mel Karmazin came on board, merged the two companies, basically petitioned the FCC, you know, said, look, we're going to go out of business, both companies. Unless you can merge us, we can trim costs. And, you know, I just, at the time, couldn't support two satellite radio companies.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I've been through all that, and we've certainly been through a lot of changes and refined the product a lot. And but it's a great job for producers because you get to work on 4 to 5 channels, and you don't have to insert any commercial content. It's all about, you know, producing for the mood of the channel.
I wanted to actually get really detailed into what people get to do there, you know, employees, producers, creative types. But just real quick, you talked about, you know, your title now, Senior Director of Music Production Marketing. Did you start essentially at the same job, or did you sort of work your way up within the company there?
I kind of worked my way up. I started as the right-hand guy. There was one head of production, and that was all talk and sports and music, everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of was his right-hand guy. And we also had a musical composer we hired who still works for me here. We were all kind of, he and I were kind of equals, the musical composer. But the first guy that started, Tom Verson, was there, and he's the one that hired me. And then when the first kind of managerial shift, basically when the initial CEO left, there was a, you know, a domino effect.
Mm-hmm.
Down to a certain level. And that's when they split up the production divisions into a talk, sports, and music division. And my team was by far the largest.
Mm-hmm.
So we also serviced the marketing department. We do a lot of, like, our TV spots we do in-house, in fact. And even though we deal with an ad agency, so
sure,
you know, we've got some pretty good studios between now, especially between the DC and New York facility. But so that's kind of what I did. And then yeah, my title then was imaging producer, senior imaging producer, manager, senior director, senior director, whatever. So that's whatever, you can call me whatever you want, as long as I get to do what I enjoy doing.
And so let's talk a little more specifically about what you do. Obviously, you're at a higher, you know, managerial position. Do you get to do any production anymore?
Well, I do. In fact, I'll probably give you audio from a couple of things where you'll hear my voice on. I still do some voice work. I do actually do one channel personally myself, and that's the 70s channel.
Okay.
Because I am a child of the 70s.
That's cool.
And so I do that hands-on. I don't really get to devote as much time as I should to it, so please don't judge the production on that channel too harshly. But actually, we have a lot of fun with it because you know, you gotta keep your hands dirty somewhat. And I don't care what you're doing, you know. And you know, I still sit behind a hot Pro Tools Pro Control and still really enjoy the hands-on stuff. I really, really do. I just wish I could do more of it, frankly.
But that's probably important to you. I mean, what if? Will there come a time where you can't do any of that creative stuff, or will you always make it a point to have some of that in your job, or else maybe that's not the job for you?
It's funny. I've been asked many times in the last several years, you know, do you want to be move up to the VP and work on the, you know, 37th floor with the suits? And not really. No, I don't want that. I like doing what I'm doing. I like being on the programming floor. It's you know, we're all in the New York facility. We're all on one floor. Stern has one little corner of the his compound, and then all the programmers are down on one end, and the studio's on the other. And you know, we've really outgrown the facility, to be honest with you. But that intimacy actually, I think, works to our favor. Because, you know, the programmers and producers just, you know, step down a hall, just like in the old, you know, radio days. You know, the programmer goes in the studio. In fact, I encourage that. I say I want to see program directors standing behind your back with your face in the Pro Tools screen. Mm-hmm. And that interaction is important. Unfortunately, sometimes we don't have the luxury of that anymore with a programmer in maybe in D.C. when their producer may be in New York. But, you know, we have Skype cams and... I encourage those sessions where they can flash the Pro Tools screen up on there as well. And, you know, I think I call it pair bonding, actually, with my staff. I say you have to pair bond with your programmer. You have to almost be like a husband and wife. The personal relationships for me are very, very important, foundational aspect of what the production is going to be on the channel. You know, and I think that's really important.
And let me ask you a little bit about how that works. You mentioned you had, I think you said 14 or 15 producers all working on multiple channels. If you have a guy, let's say, who's doing four channels, whatever formats they are, does that mirror the PD? Will there be a PD also programming the exact same channels?
No.
Okay.
No. The assignments of the producers, the puzzle does not fit that neatly, unfortunately.
But is that a good thing? It might be better that way.
I think it is. Yeah. I think it creates more diversity. The way I approach it is I generally, if you have four or five channel, depending on the load of the channel, some producers have three channels. You know, like for Hits One, that's like two channels.
Yeah.
But basically, the way I like to do it and the way I tell everybody is I want them to have one channel that they have such passion for, they do it for free.
Mm-hmm.
It's right up their bailiwick in their wheelhouse, and it's their, you know, it's their thing. They really want to do it. Then I want something that, you know, maybe they're familiar with the format, but it's not maybe their main forte. Then I like to have one or two fringe ones that really push them, because we have some very unique niche channels here.
Mm-hmm.
I said initially I worked in country music, country radio years ago. I always was drawn towards the outlaw type country. You know, when the Outlaw album came out with Waylon Willie and Tom Paul Glazer and those guys, and Kris Kristofferson and those cats, and that's the kind of country I really dug. In fact, I used to have on the WSLC in Virginia on the AM a Saturday night show called Bluegrass and Rawhide. And I would play progressive bluegrass from bands like Newgrass Revival, the Dillards, and Dog Jazz with Dave Grisman and Jerry Garcia and stuff like that.
I forget to ask you this, I'm going to get more into the producers, but there's got to be a pretty massive job, and it may not be yours directly, but of just sort of managing the talent on a platform like that. And I'm talking more like you've got a Howard Stern, and then you've got an Opie and Anthony show. And then you go to other, you know, musical formats. You've got big jocks and shows. Is there a science, or is there a team or people that really know and focus on making sure that everybody somehow stays happy in that place?
Well, I tell you, we're talking a wide array of personalities here. You got, you know, Cousin Brucey, Howard Stern, Opie and Anthony, myriad other personalities that are, you know, from crazy and nuts to, you know, very straight ahead and everything in between. But I guess what's beautiful about the you know, this is cable TV, cable radio, basically. I mean, you pay for it, so we can get away with a lot more. We're not subject, obviously, to the FCC. Restrictions, seven deadly words and all that.
Right.
It was a novelty at first. We could say the F word at five every 5 seconds, but quickly wore off and you realize, well, it almost takes the veil away from it in a way, and you have to be a little more, use a little more ingenuity, frankly. Managing back to your question, the talent, I obviously don't really do that,
no.
But I mean, it's such a, you know, you have program directors, just like you do in radio stations, and they have to deal, and their superiors and VPs of programming that deal with the real heady problem children. And if there are any, I'm not saying there are any in the building per se, but, you know, it's kind of interesting to have all these genres and formats in one or two, now two buildings. But, you know, I got off the elevator the other day, and Elvis Costello was getting on, and who was it? Lady Antebellum was coming out, you know, and it was like you run into all these people. I remember Bob Dylan and Costello were up here at the same time they were touring, and you know, what radio stations do you have that kind of daily interaction with, you know, a lot of talent? And you know, because we have now reached our level of subscribership, we're now taken seriously, and we can get that kind of talent in here and get them to do custom stuff more than, hi, I am, and you're listening to blank. You know, we interact with we do takeovers. The person, you know, music stars will come in and do actually play DJ for a shift.
Sure.
And you know, we do weekend features built around them sometimes, and you know, the possibilities are endless, and when you have no commercial interest or anything to promote, you can't go there. That makes it all the better for producers, I think.
And do you think, as a platform, Sirius, you know, now Sirius XM, but you know, satellite radio, is doing everything it can to really, you know, just get every, you know, because you have a Lady Antebellum and an Elvis Costello in the, you know, literally the same square footage. You know, do you guys do everything you can to merge this music together and really make use of that? Or is there more that you guys can do with, you know, a Jay-Z in the building at the same time as, let's say, Madonna was there? You know what I mean?
Yeah, you mean interact with do something with both of them?
Yeah, you know.
Once and try to do, unfortunately, we're not usually that coordinated. I mean, and, you know, it's kind of like, you know, whenever they're in town promoting something or whatever. I mean, so we don't have a lot of chance to do that kind of strategic stuff. But you know, it has happened on occasion, and one of the highlights I had was years ago we did for New Year's Eve we did a radio sequel to a Blues Brothers movie. It was called a Blues Brothers 2003 Chase Odyssey, I think is what it was called, and it was basically like a third sequel to the movie, but we had literally had Dan Aykroyd come in and some actors and did this whole, you know, drama where they hit a gig, a New Year's Eve gig in every time zone for the 4 hours of New Year's Eve, and that where else can you do a show like that?
That's exactly what I'm talking about. That's, well, cool. Let's get a little more specific into, as you mentioned, you have multiple 14, 15 producers or so, and they're spread about. How does the chain of creativity work? Do you have big meetings every once in a while with everyone? Do you meet one-on-one? And what are those meetings like?
Well, I don't like meetings, okay, per se. I have a logistical meeting with my team every week, but I literally try to keep that. I put a timer, actually. I try not to go over 15 minutes. I say, all right, we need to take care of this. That's all logistics. I put together what I call hit squads when we have to build a new channel or maybe beef a channel up or work on something, project, you know, high-profile project, you know, and I'll assign a lead producer, somebody in charge. I do believe hierarchy, you know, some sort of structure is important.
Yeah.
And they work with the programmer, and then we'll have sometimes a team of three or four. Sometimes we'll build a channel overnight. You know, I need to have all hands on deck, and you know, coordinating that can be a little bit of a logistical nightmare with, you know, consistency and continuity. But you know, it generally speaking, the programmers, they're kind of in charge of writing and conceiving stuff, but it's a two-way street, and I highly encourage collaboration. I like my producers to be involved at the copy stage, you know, the conceptual stage, all the way to, you know, executing the production, and that way I think they feel much more, you know, they feel ownership of it, for one thing. Feel they can be much more involved, and I want their input, and their programmers usually want their input too. Mm-hmm. I think for all these personalities, both you know, production talent, on air, everything in these halls in D.C. and New York, I would say that virtually everyone's ego is checked at the door, and it's amazing, really, with the high profile talent, especially some of the bloviators I've known in radio over the years. it's refreshing, actually, because You know, there's a lot of cross-pollination, if you will, and that's very helpful. And, even just amongst us producers in my team, even, you know, they'll have a producer will just randomly go to another producer if they need an idea on something or how to do something. And, you know, there's a lot of great production minds in the hall here and producers. And so I do have some structure. I don't like to have big – I don't believe in big brainstorming meetings. Mm-hmm. I think if you get about four or five, six people, you start just getting into a convoluted mess. But I do put these little hit squads together with a key leader and then, you know, build a station out or improve a station, whatever.
Tell me a little bit about the quantity of work. Basically, two parts to the question. As a as a single producer there, you know, about how much work are they having to do, you know, hours in the day? And then also, well, answer that one, and then I'll go into a more general.
Do I run a sweatshop? Is that what you're
I'm
asking,
really,
basically?
Well, because I do know a few people that work there, and nobody said sweatshop, but I know there's a lot of work to be done, and I'm wondering if, you know, it's kind of, you know, constant.
Yeah, no. Yeah, part of my job is to, I think, insulate people from, you know, just upper politics, which there's not a lot of mm-hmm. I have to deal with, but I mean, you know, there are politics anywhere. But mostly to create what I call a little petri dish of creativity and isolate them from all the bullshit mm-hmm. and let them have a sandbox that they can play in that's really kind of their own world. And right now I'm down two producers. So, yes, everybody is a little too busy. We're in, you know, they've got one or two too many channels. So if you know any good producers out there who want to apply, this will have a position open, by the way.
Yeah.
I think I've got one filled already. But, you know, and honestly, I'm looking for, you know, we really have a high bar here. And we've had some really great producers pass through here, still have a lot of really great producers. I think for the most part, you know, there's always going to be the frustration of having revisions and, you know, maybe altering your singular vision, you know, to accommodate a programmer's desire or whatever. But that's, again, goes back to what I said about pair bonding. Mm-hmm. A relationship has to be there. And if you have a good, professional and somewhat personal relationship with the programmer, it's going to click. And, you know, you kind of just know that intuitively. And if it's clicking, it's great. If it's not, you know, we reassign a channel. But I do believe in a programmer or a producer rather having a channel's assignment per se than just doling out, okay, well, you do this channel today, and then the next day another producer does it. I don't think that works.
No.
Legacy XM used to do it partially that way. And I think you have some consistency, continuity issues that
I was
way.
Gonna say.
I think you really have to, get to know each other in that relationship, a programmer and producer, and that's really what it all boils down to. I mean, that hasn't changed in radio since I got into it.
Yeah, you know? No, that all sounds pretty standard. The other thing I'm curious about that, and I don't know if it's a workload question, but you mentioned launching new stations. You know, I have Sirius XM, and I have probably about 10 stations I like to listen to. So I don't really know how often new stations are being sort of conceived and produced and launched, and how often is that actually happening there?
Well, you know, you got to keep in mind we also have a lot of online channels.
That's true.
Don't go on the satellite. I mean, we have limited bandwidth with the satellites, so we can't put everything we want out there. And you know, we're out there competing with other content providers that are IP or web based. And so I think we've done a really good job at really realizing that content is king. It doesn't matter whether you're listening to our service on your iPhone, you know, through the satellite, you know, on your computer or whatever. It's all about the content.
Mm-hmm.
And so we do have a lot of channels. And, you know, I'm fortunate enough that my superiors give me the resources I need as far as the number of producers and the tools to you know, really do it without it being a sweatshop, without it being an assembly line, cookie cutter kind of production. And, you know, I'm not saying that every channel is a nirvana and perfect, and, you know, you can always do better no matter what you're working on, but some of the channels I'm very proud of the sound of, and, you know, others are works in progress always, and
It
kind of goes back to an old philosophy. I've always, as a leader, as a manager, and followed up myself actually, is never think you're the best at what you do, because then there's no more headroom left. You can't grow anymore. You're the best.
Yep.
Who the hell is the best at what they do? Nobody ever gets to that point. You stop growing at that stage. So that kind of also goes back to the ego thing. I don't have a lot of tolerance for big egos unless you have a hell of a lot of talent to go along with it. You better have a big-ass talent if you're going to have an ego in my department.
But it doesn't really sound like, from what you're saying and from the people I know there, that that's really a problem at all anywhere.
Not at all.
Yeah.
Two of my main criteria for hiring producers, of course, they have to be talented. But they don't have a big ego, and they're trustworthy. You know, I'm into building relationships, and I trust my team, and I want them to trust me, and I want them to be happy for the most part. And I think if you're happy at what you do, or not happy with what you do, it's going to bleed into your work, and vice versa, I guess.
The producers.